This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's General Assembly is just about finished up for the session here. Just a matter of, I guess, down to days, I believe, before the session at least plans to come to an end. And let's find out how things have worked so far and what is maybe likely ahead before the session does end. We have Andy Downs, who's the Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne with us. And as always, Andy, thank you for joining us on the show today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, bring us up to date with what those crazy lawmakers in Indianapolis have been doing these days. They've gotten an awful lot done here in the last, at least taken a lot of measures up in both houses, I guess, in the last 4 or 5 days.
Yeah, technically the session doesn't have to end until March 14th, but the leadership set March 10th-ish as the date that they thought they would try to get out. So they are in what amounts to the final days of the session right now. And if anyone has gone to the agendas or the calendars for today, they have seen that the House has, I think it's 50 or 52 pieces of legislation. The Senate's going to be considering 30-some pieces of legislation.
Wow.
And those are all items that are on final or third reading. So they are up for passage right now, which means a whole lot of very substantive conversations. Both chambers are going to started meeting at 10 o'clock this morning. So remember, that's political standard time, so not really 10 o'clock, but 10 o'clock. They started talking about these bills that are on third reading. There are conference committees getting scheduled and legislators who are negotiating with each other to try and get a few more things in, some of which are a big deal and some of which may not be as important to the state as a whole, but certainly important to those who follow those particular issues.
What are some of the really, really big issues that have come up here, at least in recent days, and I know a number of environmentally related issues that have come up for votes as they've been swapping, I guess, through houses and taking up these particular matters. But besides those, or including those, I guess, for that matter, what things have been really, really coming up that lawmakers should get passed and residents across the state should make note of?
Well, I think there are two ways to think of that. One are things that actually got passed, and there are also those things that have come up for conversations that may not have passed, but certainly spurred conversations. So, for example, I think it was just yesterday, there was an amendment to a bill that was going to empower public school corporations that do referendum to share that money with charter schools if they chose to do so.
Mm-hmm.
That is clearly a shift in funding issues for public education. Whether that will actually make it through or not remains to be seen. It was, I think, a tie vote that the lieutenant governor had to break in the Senate as far as that amendment is concerned. So, you know, that's one of those things that gets a lot of people excited. And even if it does not pass now, that certainly is something that people will be looking at for the future, as some folks want to put more emphasis on charter schools and vouchers as a way to provide education. So that's one way to think of it. The other way to think of it are other issues that have come up for discussion. So, for example, the way that billing happens for healthcare, which is maybe a bit bigger issue over here in terms of public coverage than it is in the western part of the state or northwestern part, but there are a couple of one in particular healthcare provider over here that was singled out in a RAND study from a year ago that said that they charge an awful lot of money, and that's been coming up, and there have been attempts to bring some transparency but also to change the way billing is done for hospitals, and that could affect rural areas. That's something that's going on right now as well. Once again, one of those things that may get through, and even if it doesn't, is certainly going to come back up again for next year.
I know in particular on that measure, the representatives from the Indiana Hospital Association really got out the effort, and they got a lot of lobbying power out there among the lawmakers, representatives of hospitals as well as doctors and nurses showing up in Indianapolis for that particular measure yesterday.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It is, you know, we have to remember that Indianapolis obviously has some wonderful health care facilities available, and the state as a whole has some very good places available. But there are counties where it's going to take a decent long drive for you to get to, certainly to specialized care, even if you're able to get really, really good primary care in your area. You're still going to have to travel a distance. I know that I can't remember which media outlet it was, but they did a piece talking with a woman who is going through chemotherapy, and she's able to get that chemotherapy at a non-hospital location right now. That would not be possible, some argue, under this legislation. Mm-hmm. And for her, she's able to get her chemo on her lunchtime right now. With this bill in place, she'd be looking at basically having to take almost every day off where she needs chemo because of the drive she would have to go through. So this is the sort of bill that has a real effect on someone's life, on everyone's life, actually, and something that deserves careful consideration, maybe shouldn't be sort of rammed through right at the end of the session when people are trying to get a lot of things done.
And you bring up that issue about the referenda and turning over referenda funding to the charter schools. That's a really sore point here in Northwest Indiana and in Lake County in particular. We know that the city of Gary has had a lot of criticism because of so many charter schools that have opened up and have taken money away from the Gary Community School Corporation. And it's at a time when the school corporation needs every single penny they can get to get things going as well as keep operations open.
Absolutely. And remember, there is a movement to make sure that all referendum are held in the November election, not in the spring election,
yeah.
Because the argument is people don't realize that they don't have to declare their party during a primary election if they want to vote just on the referendum question. And so the argument is there's not sufficient representation in a primary the way there would be in a general election. I always want to point out to people that the rules are made up for games, for sports, and for politics, and people figure out how to play within those rules. Right now, there are school corporations that think that voting in a primary is better for them because it's a smaller electorate, typically. It's easier for them to identify who's likely to come out and vote, and there are other school corporations where the November election is the one that makes sense. No matter what the change in the rules is, the school corporations are going to figure out how to run a campaign effectively, and those who don't want passage are going to figure out how to run a campaign effectively. So the small change to the rules simply means people looking for a new way to get done what they want to get done.
And one person in particular I know that will be very closely watching that aspect of the measure is your West Lafayette campus counterpart and colleague, Larry DeBoer, who keeps a very close track of not only all kinds of state funding and local and area funding, but also school district referenda as well.
He absolutely does, and although he probably doesn't like it said that often, he is considered to be a rock star among school finance people.
Well, it may be said, but it's proven that he is that, to be sure. Well,
Well,
finally, as we kind of wrap things up, at least for this conversation, Andy, what do you think within the last days here, and particularly this week, are we likely to see taken up by the General Assembly and pushed on in the hopes of getting it to the governor's office?
Given the volume of things still left to work on, that is hard to say.
Yeah.
And as soon as I say it, I'm going to have to tell you, let me come back on later on to tell you why I was wrong.
Well, we'll have you back on later, but you know.
But I do think that a couple of the things, I mean, for example, the vaping, smoking legislation still hasn't moved yet. So there are a couple of things that people might consider to be low-hanging fruit that could get through quickly. There are some election issues that could get through still. And then teacher evaluations, another issue that might come through. So in the end, the legislators want to be able to say they addressed the major issues they said they wanted to. Education is something that deserves some focus. So I think that's part of the reason I think those things will still get through. And then things related to smoking and vaping, those are good public health issues, and quite often not particularly controversial, except for those who sell the vaping products,
yeah.
Obviously. So I think those might be places to look. And then, of course, I could add more to that list, but I'll stop for right now and just explain why I was wrong later.
Well, we'll have you back on to make some corrections and make some predictions that may have come true, to be sure. Thank you, Andy, for being with us to talk about them today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Andy Downs. He's the Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. People are concerned all around the nation and around Indiana about the coronavirus as we watch and listen to the news to find out the latest about how the virus is spread not only around the world but around the United States. What is the coronavirus? Let's find out more about it, and in particular, how folks here in Northwest Indiana are preparing for it, because it's very possible it could land here, so to speak. We're going to talk now with Dr. Eric McHitis about the virus itself and how Franciscan Health is preparing for it. Dr. McHitis is an internal medicine specialist, but he is the Vice President for Medical Affairs at the Franciscan Health Crown Point facility. And thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Well, first, tell us more about the coronavirus, what we know about it right now, and I guess maybe the closest relative, if you could call it that, might be the flu. What are the differences? What are the similarities?
Sure. I think just to kind of level set, coronavirus is something that's been around for a very long time. The normal strains that we're usually exposed to will cause kind of upper respiratory infection, cough, sniffles. We have had kind of new viruses that have come about that are also part of that same coronavirus family, and some of them are probably somewhat familiar. You've probably heard of SARS and MERS. Those have been in previous years. Those are also part of that same virus family. So as it's being called now, COVID-19, so coronavirus disease 19. 19 is from the year that it all started. And as I think most people are aware, the epicenter of that was in China. It's similar to influenza in the sense that it's a virus, and we're seeing typically, we talk about mortality rates and all of that. Influenza is, 20 to 24,000 a year. Bad years, we may see up to about 60,000. So when you do the math, it ends up being about a 0.1%, 0.2% mortality rate with influenza. Coronavirus, this new virus, there's current numbers are significantly higher than that, but there's a lot of within the medical community, some kind of, discussion about, are we really just seeing the sickest of the sick right now? Given the testing capabilities worldwide, we're probably only screening those really sick patients. So the current thinking is that number is extremely overinflated. So they're estimating it's probably going to be very similar to influenza in the sense of how people are getting sick, how well they do afterwards, as they kind of go through the disease process. In general, we're expecting it to be somewhat similar to influenza. Now, with that said, it is a little bit, especially for the general public, a little bit scary in the sense that it's new, and there are some differences in the sense that right now testing is being ramped up. The government in general is trying to kind of get in front of it and ramp up the testing kits and the availability for it. Influenza is something we can do just at the hospital level right now because this new virus is so new. We're having to send out tests as of last week from Indiana to the CDC in Atlanta. And more recently now, the state of Indiana is able to, at the state lab in Indianapolis, perform testing. Because of the limited testing capability and because of the very specific reasons that we would test, state's Department of Health actually helps healthcare facilities and clinicians kind of walk through the algorithm for who's recommended for testing. So before they'll actually approve sending down the test for screening, it is very specific. It's anybody with travel to or direct exposure to somebody who has contracted the disease or traveled to China, South Korea, Iran, Italy, Japan, kind of those high-risk areas, the areas where we're seeing kind of the bigger outbreaks. So that's kind of the general look at the disease. In terms of Franciscan, right now we're, very much focusing on, the main effort, I'd say probably 90% of what we're doing right now is education and awareness for our frontline clinicians, hospitals and our physician network clinics. We're also working with our emergency preparedness teams, both at the hospital level as well as the district level. We've been stocking through that work with the emergency preparedness teams. We're stocking additional personal protective equipment. So with this virus specifically, it's recommended that healthcare professionals use kind of the heavier dutier mask. It's called an N95 mask. So it's not just that regular face mask that you would wear for someone with, let's say, maybe pneumonia. Our supply chain at the corporate level is also working with our suppliers. We're making sure that we don't, that we have kind of a plan B for any suppliers who might be sourcing the equipment out of China as this situation evolves. There is a chance that that supply may be a bit of a bottleneck, so we're looking at kind of secondary sources where we can get additional resources from. So that's already in place. We're kind of looking at plan B and C down the road so that we're ready. In terms of general public, Chris, I think that was another question you had asked about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of, you know, if you look online, we're seeing a lot of runs on masks and availability. You know, this is some price increases, even if you look on Amazon for these masks. The general recommendation from CDC is that that isn't very helpful, just for walking around in public, to start, you know, wearing masks all the time. These masks really are only good for 20 to 30 minutes once they get, you know, moist. They don't really act as a great barrier anymore. And without proper training, removing them, there's a high risk of contaminating yourself, even if you are exposed. Really, the general recommendation is not to really wear them out in public or start trying to buy them up, kind of just in case, and keeping them at home. And then to protect yourself, it's really all the same stuff as influenza. You know, standard precautions, right? Hand washing, covering your cough and your sneeze, you know, not touching your eyes, your nose, your mouth when you're out and about. You know, anybody who's sick, kind of, and this is more in general, not just for coronavirus, anyone who's sick, if you're sneezing those droplets, it's about a 6-foot radius of, you know, those droplets traveling out. If it lands on surfaces, those surfaces can remain contaminated for several hours. So if you think about, you know, someone sneezing or, you know, then touching a doorknob, that's contaminated, and you touch that and then you touch your mouth or your nose, you've basically infected yourself. So, you know, being very mindful about not touching your face when you're out in public without first washing your hands. And I think most importantly, staying home if you're sick. We're recommending for all of our healthcare workers, if you've developed a fever, if you're having, you know, those upper respiratory symptoms, really you should be staying home, kind of self-quarantining until you're fever-free for at least 24 hours without using, you know, Tylenol, ibuprofen, fever-reducing medications. You want to be, you know, not coming back to the workplace until you're fever-free.
Dr. McInnes, I know that this has been talked about before, and of course with the flu, it's always important to avoid contact with somebody who's sick and trying to deal with that. But I understand, too, that not only do you have the person-to-person contact of possible infection, but sometimes it's even just contact that it may not necessarily be person-to-person with some certain amount with surfaces. Is that the case with coronavirus?
Yes, it's very much just like influenza. It's the same idea. So if you have a contaminated surface, let's say, you know, someone with the flu or coronavirus sneezes and it all lands on a table and you've touched that and then you infect yourself, that's where you get that kind of community infection where it may not be, you may not even realize you were kind of indirectly in contact with someone who was sick. But you, because through touching kind of the same surfaces, being in that same enclosed environment, you've now contracted from somebody who you didn't even realize really was exposed.
I understand that, of course, this all originated in the Wuhan province of China, and I understand that a lot of the original cases of coronavirus came about from people that were dealing in open-air markets, and in particular, people who are handling animals that were in the market, and normally they would be handling them anyway. It's their regular diet in some cases, but somehow or another they got infected. Is that something that we have to watch in particular? Certainly is what you eat and how you eat it?
Well, so here it's, I think, less so of an issue. What we've seen with most of these, even SARS and MERS, and now with COVID-19, what we're seeing is that there's oftentimes a transition, kind of animal or source, where you get a mutation with the virus and then it starts to infect humans. So in this case, I've heard two possible sources. I think bats and snakes are kind of the two things that I've heard the most of. I think bats kind of leading the leading theory right now. For where this came from, I should say.
Well, it sounds like it's something just to watch out because it seems to be changing and developing as it goes along, and we're just doing the best we can, I guess, to deal with what's out there and to try to resolve it as best as we can.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr. McInnes, thank you for spending time with us to talk about the coronavirus and certainly how Franciscan Health facilities here in Lake County and around Northwest Indiana are dealing with the possibility that there will be cases of coronavirus that may show up over time. Thank you for your help in explaining things and keeping us apprised as to how the hospital system's working on it.
Well, thank you, Chris, and thanks for having me on the program.
We're talking with Dr. Eric McInnes, who is the Vice President for Medical Affairs at the Franciscan Health Crown Point facility, and he is an internal medicine specialist. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Building Northwest Indiana, and here's Kevin Comerford.
Thank you for joining us today for another edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio, sponsored by the Construction Advancement Foundation of Northwest Indiana. I'm your host, Kevin Comerford. I serve as the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation. The purpose of Building Northwest Indiana Radio is to give you a little insight into the professional construction industry of Northwest Indiana. My guest today is Nick Larson. Nick is an estimator and project development manager at Larson Danielson Construction. Today we will be talking about his career path and go over some of the other management career paths available in the construction industry. Located in LaPorte, Indiana, Larson Danielson is a building and construction company that specializes in medical, education, commercial, and municipal construction projects. Nick, thank you for joining us today on Building Northwest Indiana Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So can you give us a little insight into Larson Danielson, your company, and what you do? What is your role there at Larson Danielson Construction?
Certainly. Well, Larson Danielson is a commercial general contractor that also provides construction management and design build services. We also self-perform in a number of trades, including concrete, carpentry, masonry, steel erection, selective demolition, and a little light earthwork. We've been in business for about 112 years now. 2020 will be our 112th year in business. We have designers in-house for the design-build type projects that we handle. And, we primarily serve the commercial markets that would include manufacturing, distribution. We also do the municipals. You pointed out schools, city halls, police stations, fire stations.
Well, you know, I wanted to follow up with one thing that you said there is you said you self-perform some of the work. A lot of our listeners might not be familiar with the construction industry. Why don't you self-perform everything?
Good question. It's very difficult to become an expert in everything is what it would take to self-perform work and gain the resources to do such. So we've self-performed in the areas that we do for quite some time, kind of put together a building shell is what we can do in-house. Things like electrical work, mechanical work, that takes a whole nother specialty and something that we haven't really gotten into. It would be a very large investment for us to do such a thing.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about your role within the company? I know you said you're an estimator and you are also a project development manager. What does all that entail?
So, I've been with the company for 9 years, and as a family member in the family business, worn many different hats during my time at Larson Danielson. Right now, I'm primarily estimating, which is essentially determining what a project is going to cost before it gets built. A little nerve-wracking, but I've also been a project manager before, managing the projects, which comes after the estimating phase, and managing the construction of a project, which includes managing the subcontractors, procuring materials, making sure things happen on time. And a project development manager is kind of a hybrid estimator, but also business developer, pre-construction coordinator. And what I mean by that is someone who may take a project from a concept, a napkin sketch, to the phase where it can be estimated, where there's enough drawings and specifications and details that it can be determined what a project's going to cost and what it's going to take to get it built.
So how did you get into the construction industry? I know you said it's part of your family makeup. I think generations of your family have been involved in construction. But have you always wanted to get into construction? Is that what you went to school for?
So I've kind of bounced back and forth in my life. In my younger years, I did want to go into construction. In college, I started to stray a little bit away from it. I started in construction engineering management at Purdue and decided that that wasn't the best path for me. And so went into the business school and got a degree in economics. At that time, I wanted to become a stock trader, possibly, or go into the world of finance. But graduating college in 2008 was a bad time for possibly going in that direction. So as luck would have it, was able to get a job at Walsh Construction, working up in Chicago in their commercial building side there, and worked there for 3 years and found that I really did enjoy working in the construction industry and that my economics degree actually did provide quite a few benefits that can be used in the roles I've served in construction. So I've loved it ever since then, and realized that finance probably wasn't the best direction and what I wanted to do, and here I am.
So in past episodes, we have talked a lot about careers in the construction industry, but we've been focused mostly on the trade careers. These are your carpenters, your laborers, iron workers, you know, the trades of that sort. But we haven't really talked a lot about management careers, and I'm glad I'm talking to you today, because I kind of want to pick your brain a little bit about those management careers in construction. When I was working at Superior Construction, it seemed like a lot of the people in management came up through the trades, but I'm seeing more of a trend towards the management people going through the college career path, or maybe a hybrid of both. What are you seeing in the industry where you work, especially in the commercial sector or with Larson Danielson?
There are a lot of different paths to a lot of different positions in the construction industry. And yeah, recently, college degrees have been something that a lot of employers will look at as a prerequisite to becoming either a project manager or an estimator or any of the other different, I'd say, you know, management level positions that contractors have. However, I've seen individuals, both young and old, make their way into those types of positions in various ways, you know, coming up through the trades. Some of them get an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree. Sometimes they'll take some classes to educate themselves. Sometimes they just express an interest with the company to work towards that position, and the company will help give them the resources to work in that direction and eventually be in the position of a project manager or an estimator. A lot of education in the construction industry happens at the company level. I had learned, even though my degree was in economics, I had worked in construction growing up, loading trucks, sweeping floors in the shop at Larson Danielson. And that definitely helped me understand the basics of what things were, equipment, tools, materials. And then when I got to my job at Walsh Construction on the first day, I was handed a spec book and asked to put together a submittal schedule, and I had no idea what that meant. So asking a lot of questions was important, and learning just by feeding off of the individuals and your peers around you was kind of how I was able to make it and grow into that construction role, again, if you know, with an education that didn't necessarily play into construction. So open my eyes to how you don't have to be an engineer to become a project manager and estimator in construction. Young people coming into the management roles, such as project manager, estimator, business development, really what it takes is drive and the willingness to do the work. And a lot of employers, once they see that, are willing to educate the individual to give them that technical knowledge or knowledge of the details. Maybe it's a software, maybe it's a process that, you know, takes place if they're not already aware, to get into the role that an individual may be looking to get into and to succeed in that role.
Well, that'll do it for today's segment of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Comerford. I would like to thank our guest, Nick Larson, for coming on and talking a little bit about managerial careers. To find out more about Larson Danielson Construction, you could go to their website, ldconstruction.com.
You can hear part two of this conversation next week here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Support for Building Northwest Indiana is brought to you by the Construction Advancement Foundation. And you can hear Building Northwest Indiana right here on Regionally Speaking during the middays here on Lakeshore Public Radio on Tuesdays, 89.1 FM on the radio. And the podcasts are available right now on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
The United Church of Christ, the denomination, were four churches that came together in 1957, but the original churches, like the Evangelical and the German Reformed Church, they go back to Pilgrims and Puritans, but many of those members were abolitionists. And so when the Amistad came, when that ship came in, John Quincy Adams, who was a former president, was one of the lead lawyers on that case, and they won. And when they won the case, they had to get money together to send them back to Africa. And during that time, they were taken in by the Congregationalist Church, was a part of this church, and people gave money, and they invested that money, and some of that money through investments still exists, and that's the money they used to build this church. So, you know, and I knew nothing about the denomination at all. One of my cousins said, you need to go hear Jeremiah Wright because he's talking and pulling together for you, because I'd always been involved in justice, never saw the connection between church and the justice. And she said, I think you need to hear him. I went, and then I really got involved with that church and then ended up here. That's kind of how it all comes together for me. At that time, I never knew I was being called to ministry. And that was like the furthest thing from my mind. But in the process, while we were putting this church together, that's when I realized I had been called to ministry. I think Trinity United Church of Christ in Gary is a very different church. We're committed to the community. And in saying that, I mean that on Saturdays, we call it a soup kitchen. Probably could count the number of times they've had soup on your left hand. They have a meal. We have a wonderful clothing ministry where people donate clothes. And now we've gotten to the place where every Saturday, if people come in to eat, they can also get gently used clothes. We also give away Thanksgiving baskets. In the last 2 years, we've given away 500 baskets. And we're not a big church, as you can see. We're not. But we really believe that our commitment, as Jesus Christ was, committed to people and to the community. So the other thing that we don't do, when people come in, we don't grab them and say, okay, you got to come to church on Sunday. No, we're here to serve people. We hope that in their seeing our openness and commitment that they will want to become a member of this body of Christ. But, you know, that's not something that has to happen. We're just trying to do what we're supposed to do. And we are located right in the middle of Gary, Indiana for a reason, because that's where the work is. And that's just an extension of my justice work, because we believe that there is justice work to be done through the ministry of Jesus Christ.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Lawmakers are working to roll back a nearly decade-old policy for evaluating teachers. It would let school districts decide how much weight to give student test scores on performance evaluations. Supporters call it a huge win for schools and say it could help boost the pipeline of new teachers. And as the proposal gains momentum, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay tells us more about testing's role in schools and why it matters to more than just educators.
Indiana's state tests have changed half a dozen times for students in the past decade, and with so much on the line, teachers, schools, and families are trying to keep up. Shawanda Tyson found out her son had autism in 2012. She didn't know what that meant for her or her son's future, but she was determined to find out.
I started researching, and I said, oh, this can really get scary. This can really get messy.
Tyson says she's been active in her son's education, but it hasn't been easy. She's had to leave work and sit with him in class, with testing always in mind.
You know, my son is currently right now sweating. If he passes the test, if he don't pass it, he's going to summer school.
Tyson is sharing her concerns because many lawmakers want to let schools move away from using test scores in teacher evaluations. She says if teachers are doing their jobs well, kids should pass tests that align with what they're supposed to teach.
If they're centering their curriculum around this test and the things that they're doing on the test, and the kids fail it, we have to have some accountability.
That idea, holding teachers accountable, helped spur a national movement to tie test scores to teacher performance back in 2011. Policymakers wanted to boost student achievement, but teachers argue using test scores in evaluations isn't effective, can limit a teacher's pay, and as a result, drives people away from the profession. And when you look at the data, test scores don't always reflect teacher ratings. Of the 72,000 teachers in Indiana, fewer than 900 received low ratings last year. Most of them received high ratings. The same year, just over a third of kids in the state passed the new iLearn test.
You want to know that the educator in that classroom knows their content, but also knows their students.
That's Indiana State Teachers Association President Keith Gamble. He says good teachers know the curriculum, but they also know things like how to direct kids around the classroom and how to navigate students' unique needs. Besides, not all learners are built the same. Gamble compares testing to a foot race. He says the finish line, the test, doesn't consider where or how students start the hypothetical race. Things like what age they came to school, whether or not they went to preschool, and challenges in their home life.
That's where we have veered off course, that we do not have a system that celebrates the great work that is happening with those that are making great improvement over where they started, because we're so consumed with where are they at this one point in time.
So what have test scores told us? Data shows significant gaps in passing rates between high-income and white children when compared to black and low-income kids, English learners, and special needs students. And House Education Committee Chairman Bob Boehning says that can help target support.
I truly believe that walking away from it totally kind of exposes kids, minorities especially, to everything's fine, let's just move forward.
And parents like Shawanda Tyson worry about kids being left behind. She says if teacher evaluations move away from student test scores, schools need to help parents better understand how teachers are held accountable.
I would like for them to be more transparent and to have a very open door policy when it comes to curriculum and showing what is being taught.
And as policymakers and schools decide how to use test scores, Tyson says it's important to remember why educators are there in the first place, to help kids learn. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
This is Women's History Month, and Purdue University Northwest is celebrating Women's History Month with a series of informative and inspirational presentations, and they include such things as an open forum discussion and some distinguished speakers, as well as a movie showing. In fact, the next one in the series is coming up here on March 7th, and it is entitled Believing in Restorative Justice. And to tell us more about the program and about the series in general, we have Kimberly Trzaskowski, who is the Associate Director for the Office of Equity and Diversity at Purdue University Northwest with us. Kim, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
This is a very interesting series of topics here. Let's talk first in general about Women's History Month and about the importance of Women's History Month these days.
Okay. Well, from my opinion is that, of course, everybody knows that women have played an impactful role in history, in the country and the world, and they've done some significant things. And I think highlighting those women, past and present, is very important. And Purdue Northwest has done a remarkable job in making sure that happens. So there's a lot of activities, a lot of things going on just to support and encourage not just women, but men too, to recognize the importance that women have played. I also think it's important that we get the message out to younger men and women, because sometimes they feel as though history is something that happens like eons ago, and they don't realize that it's happening every day and they can be a part of that. So that's kind of our message.
I suppose this even goes beyond students at Purdue Northwest. Even we're talking about members of the community. If you've got teenagers, for example, that maybe don't get this much information and they need to know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think when you talk about empowering people, women in particular, it's important to get that message out, like you said, not just to the Purdue Northwest community, but our community at large, our young people, our, you know, Gen Zers, Gen Xers, that kind of thing. So millennials, I guess I should say.
Mm-hmm. There are a couple events that are happening this week, and if we may, let's start in here. If you can fill us in about the open forum, which actually is coming up here, this week on March 5th, and the title of it is "Why Feminism Matters," and it's a very interesting panel that you all have together for this event that's going to happen on March 5th.
Okay, I believe that's Dr. Colette Morrow may be facilitating that. There's so many different activities. I think there's about, oh, I can't even imagine, 8 or 10 things that are going on right now. And there are different people within different parts of the university who are kind of running point on different events.
So but it's interesting, though, that they all have this one common theme of Women's History Month, but they all fit together, don't they?
Yes, absolutely they do. Again, the point is empowering women, sharing the story of women, the contributions of women in history for people who may or may not know at mm-hmm. this, you know, at this point.
I know the one in particular that you're most involved in is the one we mentioned at the outset of our conversation, which yeah. is dealing with is believing in restorative justice. It's coming up on March 7th. And it's a Saturday, and it's going to happen at Alumni Hall on the Purdue Northwest Hammond campus in Hammond. Tell us about the topic itself and about the special speaker who's going to come in, because she has an amazing story or stories to tell herself.
Absolutely. I'm very, very, very excited to be featuring Taylor Dumpsum. Taylor is a young, I call her definitely a history maker. I was here a few months ago, probably in September, and doing some work, and I saw Taylor's story come across news feed, CNN. And basically, what was exciting about that is that Taylor was the first African-American female to be elected student body president at American University. And like, I think, 124-year history, she was the first one. So that was exciting in and of itself. But the down part of that is because of her victory, she was started to be trolled on the internet and targeted by white supremacists. So what kind of caught my attention in addition to that was that this is a young woman, a college student, who actually stood up. She wasn't afraid. She wouldn't, I mean, I'm sure she was afraid initially, but she took that and she empowered herself to stand up and fight back. And I think that's important. Like I said, to empower young people, I'm passionate about social justice, equity, and when you see a young person who is just as excited and just as passionate, that really inspired me to bring her here. So because, you know, we're a college campus, most of our students are traditional age students, and I think it's important that they hear, because sometimes students don't feel like they have a voice, or they're not as powerful. So this is what kind of brought this to my attention. She's an amazing young woman, and I'm very, very excited that she's going to be here on Saturday.
Now, Kimberly, I understand there are two organizations on the Purdue Northwest campus mm-hmm. that are helping work together to help mm-hmm. bring this particular event about, the Black Student Union and a group that is called SWAP.
Yes.
And if you will, tell us a little bit about each organization, about what the Black Student Union is all about and what they do, and about what SWAP is. And SWAP is just an anagram. It's just mm-hmm. just the initials for the full name, and I'll let you explain that. That sounds very interesting.
Okay. So the SWAP is an organization focused on empowering young women on campus. The acronym stands for Sisters with a Purpose. I am not the advisor to that. Ms. Tatiana Colby is the faculty staff advisor for SWAP. And what they do mm-hmm. is plan various community events. They support each other academically, personally. They set up mentoring programs. So they do a lot for the women on campus. All women are welcome. Doesn't matter age, race, color, creed, they're welcome here. So they're just trying to create a safe space, a supportive space for the women on Purdue Northwest campus. And again, Tatiana Colby is the advisor. Mm-hmm. I'm the advisor for the Black Student Union here on campus. And basically, same thing. We just want to provide a supportive space for Black students, just to promote a sense of belonging, identifying, and just increase cultural awareness to the entire Purdue Northwest community. So, yeah, those two organizations are working together. They collaborate a lot with a lot of other student organizations. But because SWAP is particularly an organization that empowers women, and I'm the advisor of the Black Student Union, we thought it would be a good partnership, and it has turned out to be.
Now, once again, the Believing in Restorative Justice is one of the programs mm-hmm. in the series happening on the Purdue Northwest campus for Women's History Month. It's going to happen on Saturday, March 7th, and it's going to be at the Alumni Hall, which is, by the way, inside the Student Union and Library Building on the 173rd Street campus. And if anybody's interested in learning more, how can they find out more about this event that's coming up this weekend?
They can absolutely contact the Office of Equity, Diversity, Inclusion at 219-989-2163, or of course they can go to our Purdue Northwest website, www.pnw.edu, and find out more information.
Well, Kimberly, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about one of the several programs that are underway at Purdue Northwest during Women's History Month, and we appreciate you spending time with us today. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Kimberly Trzaskowski is the Associate Director of the Office of Equity and Diversity at Purdue Northwest. In many states, emergency medical services are not considered essential, like police or fire. That means when you call 911, there's no guarantee that an ambulance will respond. And that's a big problem out in rural areas, as we find out in this from Side Effect Public Media's Natalie Krebs.
Donna Hansen says when her husband started having severe chest pains 4 years ago, the plan seemed straightforward. Her daughter would drive him to the local fire station 2 miles away in their town of Hudson, Iowa, to get an ambulance.
She called 911 and then told them, I will just meet you in at the firehouse. They just felt that would save time.
But the plan fell apart. Hansen says at the fire station, an ambulance was ready with a driver, but no EMT was available. That meant the department called the backup service, a hospital 20 miles away. But Hansen says as her husband's condition deteriorated, her daughter decided she couldn't wait. She took off speeding down the road, passing every car.
One time her dad said to her, you need to be careful because you're going to kill us both.
Hansen recalls that day in 2016 as she points to an intersection 7 miles from her house. This is where the ambulance met her daughter's car.
They came off the interstate here, and then right here on this corner, right here is where they actually loaded him. It was right there.
Hansen's husband, Tim, passed away at the hospital from a massive heart attack. Now, she says she wonders if the delay in emergency care made a difference.
Him not getting the care that he needed at the time could have completely changed everything.
Mark Sacken is the president of the Iowa Emergency Medical Services Association. He says cases like Hansen's are the reality of rural EMS today. 3/4 of the local departments are volunteer-run, and because the service isn't guaranteed by local or state funding, many get their money from billing patients and throwing bake sales.
But I think we're to the point now where the demands on the system are far exceeding the available resources available to provide those services.
The numbers are grim. 14 counties are covered by just one ambulance service, while one, Worth County, doesn't have any for its 400 square miles. And this is a problem nationwide. One report found more than 2/3 of EMS directors have a problem retaining and recruiting volunteers. That leaves rural departments struggling to cover emergencies. In the town of Tripola, Director Kip Ladeghi has just a handful of EMTs to cover 99 square miles in Bremer County.
From, say, 6 in the morning to 6 at night, we probably have 2, maybe 3 if we're lucky, that are available.
Ladeghi says staff shortages in neighboring areas can create a domino effect.
What if Tripola can't cover and Denver's already out and can't cover? Then where do we go? Then that response time just gets that much longer.
In Wright County, local official Carl Helvigold says they reached a breaking point in 2016 when one of their small towns stopped its service.
It was always, you know, the elephant in the room that no one wanted to address.
In 2018, voters overwhelmingly approved a property tax levy to make Wright County the first in the state to declare it as essential and fund it. That raised $500,000 a year for training, equipment, and a countywide EMS coordinator. But Helvigold feels EMS is something the state needs to ensure.
Would it be great if the state had a way to mandate it and fund it in a perfect world? Yeah, but we don't live in that type of world right now, so we need to do what we need to do and provide good service to our citizens.
Several proposals in the Iowa legislature would make it easier for counties to make it an essential service and increase state funding this session. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Natalie Krebs.
Indianapolis-based restaurant company Steak and Shake is shifting away from its traditional sit-down dining outfit concept to countertop service. That's after another year for the company of increased losses. The company lost more than $18 million system-wide last year. Now, details in the annual report to Steak and Shake shareholders show that drive-thru sales have been increasing, so the food chain is looking at ways to speed up service. Indiana University Kelley School of Business professor Lopo Rejo says that the changes are necessary, but mentions that the management is going to have to communicate with their customers about all of this.
Everyone that has gone to Steak and Shake expects to see something, right? They may not value it as much as they did, say, 10 years ago, but they still expect to see it there.
Rejo says that the other piece that is critical to the Steak and Shake companies returning to profitability is having more franchise operations instead of the company-owned stores that they have mostly right now. That is changing, but not as quickly as the Steak and Shake ownership would like. That's it for Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.